Well, it was a full and a good afternoon, and I enjoyed getting to interact with some of you today and to make connections both after the service this morning and then over some food as well. And so thank you for being hospitable towards us. One thing that's interesting in the book of Genesis, book of Judges, hospitality is no small deal. And so both the account given in Genesis 18 and 19, as well as Judges chapter 19, reminds us that hospitality is the counterpart, surprisingly enough, and the antidote for homosexuality. If your culture is not going to go the route of homosexuality, then you need to be a hospitable people. And Ezekiel makes the connection. Because Sodom had food and prosperity and ease and did not take care of people, poor people and those who were in need, but rather indulged their appetites, then they turned to abominations. And so their inhospitableness ended up creating their immorality. And so it's been kind of interesting to realize that for all the conservative talk about a bunch of things, if I don't actually live my life hospitably, I am not contributing to this nation's future and its longevity. No matter what I vote next month, how I use my home and how I use my life is a lot more telling in the long run for my contribution. Well, let's turn to Exodus chapter 19. We're at a break in the book, and I want to go global on you for a second. If we can go big picture for a little bit and just say, you know what? If context is what's necessary for understanding, then I think the context of the whole Bible at some point plays into an interpretation of a passage and an interpretation of a book. And it's been interesting to find out among evangelical Christians, those who base their faith on the Bible and those who focus their attention on Jesus Christ and His work alone for their salvation, there really are only two theories or two stories of how the whole book is put together. One of them is covenant theology, which is held tightly by those who still want to baptize their babies and that side of Reformed Christianity, very, very tight hold on that, because covenant theology is what ends up being their main basis of support. If you take away covenant theology, you're not left with many texts to actually support that practice. And so that story of the Bible of two great covenants of God, a covenant of grace or covenant of works, even though Calvin only talked about the first and not the latter, those two great covenants become the backdrop for the whole Bible and kind of the picture of how the Bible is put together. On the other side is the dispensational story, which kind of has some shady beginnings back in England. And it's interesting, a very controversial and either conflicted character, John Nelson Darby, is behind a lot of that beginnings of that story. But it puts together the Bible in a series of kind of like crises that develop new ways of God interacting with people, new dispensations or administrations, sometimes seen as seven. And so depending on your background, you grew up with one or the other, and it seemed natural and normal. I mean, it was so natural in my house. I remember in seventh grade being able to take like a chalkboard, that shows my age a little bit, take a chalkboard and draw out the whole scheme of like the end of times. You know, like this happens. Usually there's a lot of vertical arrows, you know, going up and going down, you know, like the rapture and then this and that and the other, and holding it, drawing all the big picture out, because my dad and my grandpa both taught that dispensational scheme through and through. It was kind of what we ate, you know, that was theological food, and we'd have prophecy conferences and, you know, that kind of a thing. And then, you know, getting in grad school and learning about, you know, the background of Reformed theology and the federal covenant and the idea of federal, which is Latin for covenant, and then realizing how that scheme's put together. And for 2 months of our lives, you know, going to a Presbyterian Church of America, PCA Church, You know, contemplating, should I become Presbyterian? It's really a poignant question when you have children and they're really young. You know, do I baptize them or don't I baptize them? So that was like thinking. Well, if you have some awareness of the theological world out there, these are moving targets. You know, because on the one side, one's kind of moving closer this way, and then the other's moving a little closer in the middle. And so there seems to be a lot of rethinking going on among Bible-believing Christians and theologians, where certain elements of this story and certain elements of that story are kind of put together, and they're starting to converge in some sense. So who knows? We may end up seeing a development in the future where that kind of big picture is put together quite well. Tonight, I want to use that as the backdrop and the big picture to say the covenants, number one, are very, very important in that story. We have tonight before us, at the heart of Exodus, a covenant. A covenant of God with his people made at Mount Sinai. Perhaps the most, say, safe title to call it is the Sinai Covenant. The covenant at Sinai. A covenant is a promise that has a difference. It's a covenant sealed, it's a promise sealed in blood on oath. Or you might say on oath and sealed in blood. It has a sacrifice attached to it. Jeremiah 33 says that they would divide the animal and then walk through the middle, apparently signifying, may this happen to me if I break the covenant. I like to tell in premarital counseling, though I don't think it's so accurate, what if the bride walking down the middle of the aisle had that same significance, you know, that she walks between the two halves and may I be divided in half if I break this covenant. Perhaps we'd have a few lesser divorces if covenants and marriages were treated so seriously. And so, you know, there's a shedding of blood and a sealing of it with that blood. And then an oath where the this promise is as true as God exists. It's a very, very solemn arrangement. God never breaks a promise, never breaks a covenant. Ever, ever. Covenants are absolute with God. Genesis gives us a big covenant in the Abrahamic covenant. God coming to Abraham and saying, I will make you a great nation. And I will make you a blessing, and then I will bless all the nations of the earth, right? Not just give them this land, which is chapter 15, but also make them a means of blessing the world and all nations. Exodus gives us another covenant, the Sinai covenant. But when it gives us the covenant, it brings an element with it that has caused many theologians and scholars to ponder. It brings with it an if statement. Follow with me. Verse 1. In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came into the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. And there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Notice how slow the text is. Repeating. Slowing down the pace. Because this is very, very important. Moses went up to God. This is the first of seven ascents where Moses goes up the mountain now. He's going to do this seven times. Moses went up to God and the Lord called to him from the mountain saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. That is so personal. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession, my special possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. The The declaring of an if statement at this point is a conditional statement, and it is what theologians have pondered. Are the covenants of God absolute, that they can never be broken, that they always are fulfilled? And if such is true, then when you baptize a baby in the name of the covenant, are they set? Is it absolute? Or are there conditions? That now that they're in the covenant community, and now that they're members of this great body, that they now have a condition set upon them, that if they will obey and if they will be faithful, then they will end up in heaven someday. Is that the shape of salvation? Because it appears like God sovereignly and unilaterally calls Abraham. Yes, he obeyed by leaving his country, but once he's out of the country and in the land of Canaan, God actually puts him into a temporary coma when he gives the covenant with him. It is so unilateral, Abraham isn't even awake. It's all on God. God saying, I'm going to give you this land. Right after he says, I'm going to give you seed like the stars of the heavens. It appears to us like it is so unconditional. Absolute promise. And then we get to this point and we go, if, what's this if business? If you obey, if you indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession. Then you'll be my special bride, my special people. Then? What's this if? I don't get it. Like, is God just gonna like ditch them and go after another bride, as it were? Divorce them and find a new one? A new people somewhere? Is that what's going on? If you obey, then you'll be my special possession? And so it's caused much perplexity. How can you have an absolute? And how can you have a condition? How do these go together? Well, Israel's game for this. They're at the mountain, and God, in the first three times Moses goes up the mountain, God reiterates the importance of what's about to happen, as well as introduces a threat. So Moses calls all the people together in verse 7, sets before them all these words. All the people answer together, verse 8, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. It's as if you're kind of at the altar and you look at the bride or you look at the, do you take this one? And they say, I do. And the people say, I do. We do. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I come to you in a thick cloud so that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever. Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today. They were to prepare themselves to meet God. They were to have boundaries around the mountain. Beware that you do not go on the mountain or touch it. Touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. So Moses goes down the mountain and consecrates the people, and they wash their garments. They don't go near a woman. So on the third day, when it was morning, here comes the sound and the light show. There was thunder and lightning flashes and thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound as if a great king is approaching. So that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. And they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke. And God answered with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And again they're warned, go down, warn the people so that they don't break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them. Moses says, the people cannot come up on Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set boundaries about the mountain and consecrate it. And the Lord said to him, go down and come up, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come to the Lord, or he will break forth upon them. And so Moses went down. Do you feel the intensity? Do you feel the sense of danger? Yes, they come before the Lord, and the privilege is there. And yet, as we've seen throughout the book, there's danger with the Lord, for the consuming fire is present. They must not break through. They must not gaze, lest they perish. And the Lord has warned them and thundered against them. Don't do this. So, if there's anything that God's trying to do right now, it seems like he's trying to impress upon them the fear of God so that they would obey, tremble and obey, and be preserved. This is confirmed to us in the next chapter when the Ten Commandments are given, literally the Ten Words. The first four are unparalleled, apparently, from what I read, unparalleled in the ancient Near East. The others have many parallels of stealing and adultery and things like that that you're not supposed to do, regulated to a greater or lesser degree. The neighbor laws are very common among unbelievers, but the God-centered, God-first kind of commandments are quite unique. No other gods before me, no graven image, you must keep his name holy, and you must remember his day. So God alone, no image, no idols, God's name, God's day. And then those who act in the place of God when we're young, who are the origin of our life, honoring father and mother. And then beyond that, the neighbor commands, you shall not take your neighbor's life, you shall not take your neighbor's wife. You shall not take your neighbor's goods, and you shall not take your neighbor's name. In fact, you shall not even covet anything that belongs to your neighbor, for I am the Lord, and I brought you out of Egypt. You belong to me. Well, the people were scared at this. It says in verse 18, all the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. And they said to Moses, speak to us yourself, and we will listen. But let not God speak to us, or we will die. Moses said to the people, do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you, and in order that the fear of him may remain with you, so that you may not sin. And the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. The if statement is before them. If they will obey his voice and keep his covenant, they will be his special treasured possession. They will be a kingdom of priests, which means they will have access to God. The privilege of drawing near to God, also signified by the holy status of them as a nation. Out of all the nations of the earth, only they would have the privilege of drawing near to God. And so at this moment, they meet their new husband. As it were, a covenant was like a marriage. We know from Jeremiah that God was as a husband to them in this Sinai covenant. And I'm going to use that analogy tonight. And so before this God, who is their new husband, they realize that he is a majestic, holy presence, a threatening presence. And yet they are still game to say, all these words we will do. Chapters 21, 22, 23 give us perhaps a model code, almost like the English common law, where not everything is covered here, but you get a trajectory and an example set for a whole bunch of cases. This is case law, a whole bunch of cases on what to do in this, that, or the other situation. When they get done with that, which culminates finally with the Sabbath, and the festivals, and then the command to go into the land, Moses assembles the leaders of the people to worship the Lord at a distance. In chapter 24, he writes these things in a book, he sacrifices the animal, and he sprinkles the people with the blood of the covenant. And now that the marriage, as it were, is sealed, it is time to have the wedding reception. And so the banquet of the people, represented by their leaders, is in verse 9. Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And under his feet, there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet, he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they saw God, and they ate and drank. At this point, it looks like they're doing fairly well in keeping their end of the bargain. They've agreed, all these words we shall do. They act, they said, I do, and they said, I will. And so God has pronounced himself to be their God, and they are now his people. I will be husband to you, you will be wife to me, and we will live together. And the very next chapter then begins with, here's going to be the home we're going to live in. Let me tell you about the rooms, and let me tell you about the keepers of the house, and the priesthood, and the tabernacle. They're going to now dwell with God. His presence will be in the middle of the camp. They will be a unique nation, a holy nation in all the earth, because God will dwell with them alone as his people, and he will be their God. And this will continue if they obey and keep his covenant. Now, at this point in the book, we have little confidence in this people. We have seen that they have responded well when there was a sound and light show at the Red Sea. They believed in God and they believed in Moses. After all the plagues of Egypt, they had great confidence and worshiped, but we saw how long that lasted. As soon as they start leaving the land, the grumbling starts. It was helpfully pointed out to me this afternoon, the grumbling was primarily against Moses. And Moses thought that this was quite unfair. They're actually grumbling against you, God, and I'm the one getting picked on down here on earth. We do not have much confidence in this people sticking with their resolves. And so, while Moses is away up on the mountain, after receiving chapter after chapter of details, we open chapter 32 and find that the people are growing impatient. Or something is happening. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled around Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us." Kind of like in 1 Samuel, we want a king that will go before us, right? And the rejection there of God being their king. Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Apparently, that's an easy way to carry your gold. And so they tear off all their ornaments and they give it to Aaron. Then all the people did that in verse 3. He took it from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool, and made it into a molten calf. And they said, this calf is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. I think this playing refers to immoral playing and to activities and frenzies and orgied activities that are going to get out of hand, much like pagan religions had sexual activity as part of the so-called worship. And so the people at the floor of the mountain, at the base of the mountain, are now getting out of hand. And when the Lord actually comes to Moses and says that he should go down, he says they have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way I commanded them and have made for themselves a molten calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now, when Joshua hears later all this commotion, he's going to think it's warfare. This is a people that has lost it and given themselves over completely in unfaithfulness, both in breaking the covenant, going after another God, even if Aaron says, "Let's worship to the Lord," and definitely in disobeying the 10 words, "You shall not make a graven image, nor have any gods before me." So it is understandable when the Lord says to Moses in verse 9, "I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people." It's the same kind of language used of Pharaoh. They are a stubborn, stiff-necked people. "Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I will make you a great nation." God made a conditional statement that if they would obey, and if they would keep the covenant, then they would be his special possession. At this moment, they have not obeyed. They have not kept the covenant. And he is threatening to invoke the result. They will not be my special possession. I'm going to not just divorce them, I will destroy them. Now, when I was in seminary, graduating actually from Southern Seminary with a PhD, I was sitting up front as they put the graduate students up in the front. And I was listening to Dr. Moeller actually preach on the life of Moses. Not Moeller. It reminds me of my son making jokes about the solar system and the molar system and the polar system, which combined, dental practice with astronomy or something. My apologies to Dr. Moeller. He was actually saying from the life of Moses that, you know what, you guys are going to go into pastorates. And there's going to be days when you wish you had a different people. And Moses, as the pastor, literally the shepherd of this people, had the opportunity at this moment to have a congregation after his own image. "I will make you, O Moses, into a great nation." And it was encouraging to me, being a man that was taking a pastorate and was going to take a pastorate and had that possibility, to hear that warning from an experienced professor that that is not the option that Moses chose. He ends up praying, asking, telling, entreating, begging God, "O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why, O Lord, are you so angry?" Now, we're going to see right now within this part how the consuming fire can actually dwell with a people that make great tinder. Number one, why should the Egyptians speak, saying, "With evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth. Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to this people." Number one. At the very least, God is concerned for his international fame. He's concerned for his reputation. his name. We will find in the exile that it's because they have blasphemed his name that he kicks them out of the land, but he won't keep them out of the land long because then the nations will trash his name saying he's not really a powerful God. So he'll bring them back into the land for the sake of his name. So this is a baseline righteousness. God acts solely and ultimately for his name's sake. This is challenging for me as a dad and a teacher. Because sometimes I feel like if I love children and teenagers, I will invest in them so that they will find their fulfillment and bend my activities towards the development of them. When actuality, if I really loved them and did what was right, I would be preparing them for Christ's kingdom and whatever purposes he has in store for them. Which is ultimately what is best for them. It's ultimately loving. But it's a different kind of feel. And so the name of God is the ultimate purpose. And so the glory of God is, first of all, fundamental. If you do this, you will end up destroying your reputation internationally, especially with the Egyptians. So don't do this. Number two, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven, and all this land which I have spoken I will give to your seed, and they shall inherit it forever. The Abrahamic covenant is being invoked right here. That if you destroy them, you will break that covenant. Making a nation out of Moses is not the same thing as making a nation out of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That nation will end up being called Moses after their father, not Israel after their father. You will break your covenant. You swore to them that they'll be a great nation and inherit the land. You can't do that. So when it says in verse 14 that the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said that he would do to his people, this is not changing the mind of changing a purpose like, oh yeah, I forgot that. Oh, that's right. That's not a good idea. What it is a relenting of feeling bad. It expresses in terms of relationship that God's heart in this matter is not into destroying per se, but that is a demonstration of his right to destroy and, of course, of his thoughts towards what they did. It is anger provoking. But in actuality, what Moses is saying is keep your mind. Don't change your purpose. You covenanted with Abraham. Don't do it. And God agreed. So here is one solution to the dilemma in the earlier part about the two covenant and dispensational stories about the conditional nature of a covenant or an unconditional nature. With the Abrahamic covenant, we find here that it is absolute. God will make them into a great nation. Paul picks it up in Romans 11. The gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. The Jews may be enemies for the sake of the gospel, but they are beloved for the sake of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They are not going away because God is going to keep his covenanted promise with Abraham. So at the very least, the nation is not going to be annihilated. But the conditional nature is found in when are those promises actually going to be fulfilled? Is it going to be this generation? Or this one? Or the next one? When is a generation actually going to obey and keep the covenant in order to inherit the land and keep the land? That is as conditional as the sons of David being given their promise that if you obey my voice, then you will reign and you will be my son. David is given an absolute promise. You shall have someone on your throne. You have an everlasting throne. But that absolute promise to David is not an absolute promise to a son of David. If that son of David wants to be on that throne and have that relationship with God, that son of David must obey. Psalm 89 makes that very clear when in great pain it says, you have tossed aside the covenant. It appears you have cast down his throne. You have basically let the kingdom and dynasty of David fail. But we still believe, and that's why we're praying that you will fulfill your promises to David. Despite all appearances, we do believe you will keep your promise. It's a resurrection now that has to happen to the lineage of David. And we're in a very similar situation here with this generation. Yes, God will not destroy this generation because the covenant with Abraham, he will not destroy this nation because the covenant with Abraham is secure. But that doesn't guarantee that this generation is going to survive the wilderness, let alone inherit the land. They have to obey. And that is the conditional promise held out before them. And at this point, they have really blown it. When I teach this at the college, I like to use the analogy of a honeymoon. This is the mountain. They have not even left the mountain. I mean, we're talking about a month and a half later. They have not even left the very site of the wedding. And the bride has now gone off with some other man. I mean, can you imagine the gall to do that in the presence of the very mountain that was aflame, the very mountain that has the presence of God on it, that Moses goes up into the cloud, to do it right in the presence of God because the leader who took us out, the Moses man, is not here, and they go chasing after this golden calf that they can see. That would provoke great jealousy in any man. And it certainly provokes jealousy in God, as this text in Exodus says, I am a jealous God. And so, now what? Okay, they survived. Now what happens? Well, verse 15 tells us that, following, that Moses comes down the mountain with the tablets, the covenant, which is in writing, by the finger of God, comes down and shatters them at the foot of the mountain. He grinds the golden calf into powder, throws it on the surface of the water, and makes the sons of Israel drink it. Kind of gives me a good feel of an angry mom, you know. It's like, you're going to drink this no matter what, you know. And then they're out of control. And so it's like the sons of Levi join with Moses and Aaron, and they go out and they start killing people off and bring the people under control. And verse 30, Moses then addresses the people, you yourselves have committed a great sin. We have a big problem on our hands. And now I am going up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. Interesting, when he goes up the mountain, he describes what he means by make atonement. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people have committed a great sin and they've made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if you will, forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book, which you have written. If you're not just going to pardon them and forgive them freely, then make my life an atonement for them. Accept me as an obliteration from your book of life, from the record of the living. Let me be erased out of it if you would spare this people. It's what Paul thought, right, regarding this same people. That he would rather be accursed if somehow this people would be blessed. For he prayed for their salvation often, you remember, and desired to provoke them with Gentile after Gentile conversion into returning to the God of their fathers and accepting the Messiah given to them. Moses is of that attitude. He would rather be dead than that this people would be treated according to their sins. The Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel will go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin." Then the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. So at this point, where are we at? We had the wedding day in which they said, "I do and I will." And they had a great feast and they saw the presence of God, and it looked like the purposes of worship, which, by the way, this book from beginning to end has, I failed to mention that all along Moses was saying to Pharaoh, "Let the people go that they might worship me in the wilderness." And so God's intention all along was to bring them, as it says, to myself. I love how 1 Peter 3:18 says that Christ suffered for us that he might bring us to God. And so God brought them to himself. The wedding has happened. They saw God even. So it looked promising. And yet none of that stuck. They've thrown it all away and gone after a golden calf. And if it wasn't for Moses interceding, they'd be dead. But at this point, God is continuing the nation and continuing the plan on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant, which is what chapter 2 told us started the whole thing. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so the nation is going to continue, fruitful and multiply, and they're going to have the land. Go up and bring this people. My angel shall go before you. I'm going to give you my angel. I want you to bring this people into the land. And so it looks like the Abrahamic covenant is going to happen. There's going to be the people of God in the land of God, in the promised land of Canaan. And if you or I had been Moses, we might think, "Whew, good. At least I'm doing my job. I was told to go take these people from Egypt and bring them to the promised land. And it was a close call, but we're going to get there." Messy as it is. Chapter 33 has a break in the action that prepares us for one of the most profound conversations in the whole Bible to me. In chapter 33, the Lord spoke to Moses, "Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up from the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'To your seed I will give it. I'll send an angel before you.'" Verse 3, "Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will give it. For I will not go up in your midst, because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way." When the people heard this sad word, they went into mourning. And none of them put on his ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, "Say to the sons of Israel, 'You are an obstinate people. Should I go up in your midst for one moment, I might,'" and the Hebrew text says, "consume you." It's not that God is like going, "Moses, you bring them up. I'm done with this people." That was chapter 32. Moses entreated God, but God realizes this is a people that if I were to go into their midst, at any moment I might consume them because of the way they disobey and the way they break the covenant. Therefore, it appears that God is going to stay outside of their camp as a protective measure. For it is emphasized, "lest I destroy them or consume them." Do they have the blood of the covenant? Yes. Do they have the Passover behind them? Yes. Do they have the daily sacrifices? Well, they're coming. At this moment, to be near the consuming fire is threatening so much that God says, I can't live with you. I might consume you. Before we have the next conversation, we are told that their situation is such. The tent is outside the camp, verse 7, a good distance from the camp, that Moses would go out to the tent. And that whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would arise and stand at the entrance and gaze at Moses until he entered the tent. And then when Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, telling us that the presence of God is a good distance from the camp. When they saw the pillar standing at the entrance, all the people would arise to worship, each at the entrance of his camp. Thus, the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. And when Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the camp, from the tent. Now, this little bit is a good Hebrew interlude that tells us you need to know something before the next conversation. You need to know, yes, the tent is outside the camp, a good distance. That's what creates the situation Moses is not happy with. And yes, you also need to know Moses is a very good friend with God. God would speak to Moses face to face, the way a man speaks with his friend. And so at this moment, Moses makes one of the most audacious moves I know of any man in the Bible. And it is beautiful. Then Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people. But you yourself have not let me know whom you will send with me. Moreover, you have said, I have known you by name. And you also have found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, I pray you, if I have found favor in your sight, let me know your ways, that I may know you, so that I may find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people. And he said, my presence will go up with you, and I will give you rest. I believe the you is singular. Then he said to them, then Moses said to him, so, yes, Moses, I'll go with you, and my presence will be with you, and will give you rest. Moses said to God, verse 15, if your presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here. For how then can it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not by your going up with us, so that we, I and your people, may be distinguished from all the other people who are on the face of the earth? Three times Moses brings up the fact that these are your people. Here's what's going on by analogy. How many of you were athletes once? The once is a good word to have, but okay. All right. You know what it's like to have your personal best? You know, to have that game where you scored the most points or you know, you did the best you've ever done. It was like a personal best. But the team lost. A proud athlete comes away from that field of battle, as it were, from that contest, feeling good about himself and going, well, the team lost, but at least I did my best. And feeling pretty okay about it, or even proud about it. But a truly loving athlete, an athlete whose heart is with the team, doesn't feel good about a personal best if the team loses. What's the point of a personal best if the team itself loses? Moses is of that attitude. God has complimented Moses. God has said, I'll be with you. You will get rest. Go ahead and lead the people. I have favor upon you. I like you. And Moses turns around and says, God, if you don't go with us, I don't want to go. Don't take us up from here. Remember, it's not just me. It's I and your people. That is not the attitude I often have. You know, it's like when so-and-so has failed over here and then utterly embarrassed the whole crowd, and like, you know, at some moment I just want to kind of slide away a little bit and like go, I don't know if I want to associate with this person. You know, it's like, I feel pretty good right now that my name is in good standing. Why would I want to attach my good name with this people? And that's exactly what Moses does. God and Moses are on a first name basis. God told Moses God's name in chapter 3, I am, and I am that I am. Out of all the peoples of the world, Moses knows his name. And now God says, and Moses is repeating, that you know my name. We are friends. We're on a first name basis. And then Moses takes that special position that he has with God and, as it were, jeopardizes the whole thing by attaching himself to this people. If I have found favor in your sight, and if I have a good name with you, then I want you to bless this people with me. Or else, I don't want to go. I don't want it. That is amazing to me. It's one of the most beautiful pictures of love in a leader that I've found in the Bible. Not only was this man willing to die for the nation, blot me out, but he's willing to have his good name and the favor that he has with God only to enjoy it if a stiff-necked people get to enjoy it. I hope every pastor would have that attitude. Rather than sit, as I remember reading once in some old book, rather than sit and join with the devil in slandering the people of God in prayer and accusing them of all sorts of things, instead joining with the people, with the church, and saying, God, don't bless me unless you bless them, no matter how bad they've been, no matter what they've been doing. I want you to be gracious to this church. That's the attitude that Moses has, and I dare say that is exactly the attitude our Lord Jesus Christ has towards us. If there's any a moment in the book of Exodus that Moses becomes a Jesus figure, it is right here. The intercession that he makes on behalf of the people in saving them from utter destruction, followed by the entreaty that he makes with God, attaching his own good name and basing his appeal on that favor he has with God, to have the presence of God return to the middle of the camp. How many times has Jesus Christ done this over the last 2,000 years for his church or for individual churches? And the church of Jesus Christ still survives despite the stiff-necked and rebellious nature at times that we have witnessed. God agrees. The Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing which you have spoken, for you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name. If I could ask you a question, what makes a house into a home? It's not the furnishings, the location. It's the presence of a people, isn't it? Right? What makes a house into a home? It's the loved one that's there. That's what makes a home. My wife is my home. I'll often tell her that. Where she is home. What makes heaven, heaven? It's not the furnishings, the longevity, the location. What makes heaven, heaven, is the presence of God, is it not? As for me, the nearness of God is my good. I have made the Lord my refuge, that I may tell of all thy works. Whom have I in heaven but you, and besides you I desire nothing on earth. This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. What makes heaven, heaven is the same thing that makes a house a home. It's the presence of the loved one. It's the presence of God. What's going to make Canaan, Canaan, the promised land, is not going to be the milk and honey. It's not going to be the possession of fortified cities. It's not even going to be the destruction of the enemies. It's going to be the presence of God in the middle of the land. And it's as if Moses catches that significant thing, that all of this is about the presence of God, and that the presence of God does not go with us. We are no different than any other people on the face of the earth. It's your presence that makes us different. I don't want to go anywhere with any people who don't have your presence. Bring your presence back. That is significant. This is not in the Sinai covenant. There was no clause with a little asterisk, a little footnote on the bottom that said, oh yeah, if somebody stands up for you and intercedes on your behalf based on their good favor with God and the good name they have with him, then I'll let you slide by with a few disobediences and breaking of my covenants, and we'll make sure my presence is with you. There wasn't anything like that at the bottom of the page. It was all on them, was it not? If you obey and keep my covenant, then you will be my special possession. They didn't. But all of a sudden we have a new possibility that has arisen, that if this man, who they rejected early in Egypt, who made you a judge over us and a ruler, whom they rejected in the wilderness, why did you bring us out? To kill us? This man who has taken such abuse verbally from this people, such misunderstandings again and again, is still willing, when he had the opportunity to let them go, still willing to plead with God to not only spare them, but bless them. This man makes the difference at this moment. How can the consuming fire dwell with the people? The blood makes it possible, but the intercession, you might even say on the basis of the blood, interceding makes it a reality and a longevity. It's the same with you and I. Our salvation is not a piece of paper. It's not like Jesus Christ died for our sins and that sealed it. The sins were taken away because he died in my place, and God wrote paid in full on the piece of paper and threw it in the drawer. Done. If Jesus Christ didn't come out of the grave and ascend to heaven and intercede on our behalf, we would not survive. We need a high priest in heaven who intercedes with God and pleads on our behalf. Our salvation is not a dead contract. It's a living person who pays the price and then presses the value of that price in situation after situation after situation where we fail. That intercession is what saves us. Isn't that what Hebrews says? That he has the indestructible life, that he might live forever and save those, right? To intercede for them and save forever those who draw near to God through him. It's the intercession of Christ that ultimately saves us on the basis of the cross of Christ. And here we have Moses becoming a Christ figure in their midst. It's at this moment that Moses then asked God a huge favor for himself. Show me your glory. If we're friends, and if you have done this for me, I want to see your glory. Chapter 24 said they were at a distance. I want to be close. Show me your glory. God responds in verse 19, I myself will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. But I'll do this. Behold, there's a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock. And it will be, while my glory is passing by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. And so Moses then ascends the mountain. He cuts for himself 2 stone tablets in chapter 34. He goes to Mount Sinai, ascends the mountain, and the Lord descends in the cloud and passes by in front of him, verse 6, and proclaims, Yahweh, Yahweh, God. There's the name, the I am name of God. Yahweh, Yahweh, God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgressions, and sins. Yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. Moses made haste to bow low to the earth and worship. And he said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst. Translated here, even though. But in the text could be translated because we are a stiff-necked people. And pardon our iniquity and our sin and take us as your own possession. It appears, based on verse 9, that Moses is actually seeking confirmation for the request that has just been granted. Because it's an audacious request that God would dwell among a stiff-necked people. Show me your glory. Confirm it to me. And what he has shown to him is the name of God in color, not black and white. Chapter 3 was the black and white name of God. I am. I am that I am. I will be what I will be. Speaking of God's self-existence, speaking of God's freedom. That's a God that could do anything. In fact, if it were left there, it would appear like he could be like Allah. He could do this and then do its opposite. As if he's freedom itself. The old medieval debate was, can God be so free that he can just do wickedness? Is good defined by whatever God does, as if might makes right? Is that the way it is with God? He's that free. And what we find out here is in the secret cleft of the rock, where there's secrets being given, and a special showing is given, God takes back the hand and shows Moses the heart behind the freedom and the self-sufficient sovereignty of God. It is a heart of pure goodness. At the very heart of God is a graciousness and a compassion and a loving kindness. So much so that verse 19 of chapter 33 compares in parallel the name of God with all my goodness, with my goodness. That the name of God is the goodness of God ultimately. This becomes the chorus of Israel. Give thanks to the Lord, or confess the Lord, confess Yahweh. Openly have allegiance to this God, Yahweh. Why? For he is good. For his loving kindness endures forever. That at the heart of the universe, it's so encouraging to me. At the heart of the universe is pure goodness. Absolute pure goodness. So that you can trust this God to always use his freedom right. This is a God who keeps his promises. This is a God who does good. Yes, he will punish, by no means leaving the guilty unpunished. That's part of doing good to his son and to his people. That will happen, but that, as the Puritans used to say, is his strange work. What is actually at the heart of God, at the very core of his existence, is this graciousness and compassion and a forever loyal love of a loving kindness and a being true to a people. And when Moses hears that, he is even able to say, go with us because we are an obstinate people. That gives us the second thing that enables the consuming fire to remain with the people of God, and that's the fullness of the name of God. Not only a living intercessor that is willing to stake his good name and the favor that he has with God with a disobedient people, but also in the character of the God that he's appealing to is a heart of pure goodness, of a willingness to be gracious to any who would come to him. I remember struggling over predestination. How in the world can I know that you will receive me? Because I believe in predestination. And how do I know I'm one of your elect? And I was taught by John, verse 18 of the first chapter, that the invisible God no man has seen. The God that we believe in is the God, the Son of God, who appeared among us. He has explained him. We do not have direct access to the eternal decrees of God. We only have access to the face of Jesus Christ as revealed in Scripture. That's where the glory of God is revealed to us. And the glory of Jesus Christ shines in a moment when the leper comes to him and says, I know you can heal me. You can cleanse me if you want to. And Jesus says, I want to be cleansed. At the heart of the universe, at the heart of God, is a freedom that wants to use that goodness, even graciously, compassionately, for a people that we would say, they made their own bed and they can sleep in it. And God is gracious to them. This pattern of the I am now having color, instead of being I am that I am, or I will be what I will be, it's now filled up what he will be. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious and have compassion on whom I have compassion. That name, which now has color, is also patterned in the book of John. Jesus adapted the I am to himself. In his prayer, he said, I have manifested your name to those whom you have given me. That's the I am. He spoke it to them on the waters. He protected them with it in Gethsemane. He even proclaimed it to the Jews who picked up stones to stone him when he said before Abraham was born, I am. And they knew what he meant. That bare I am statement is followed in the Gospel of John with statements of living color. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the good shepherd. I am the door. It's as if Jesus looks to us and says, I am sovereign, I am free, but I am also whatever you need me to be. I am. I am yours. That also is at the heart of what enables the consuming fire to dwell with a stiff-necked, obstinate people. Maybe the best way to end this conference and to end this message tonight is to go back in time when maybe you were a child and somebody told you that you needed to ask Jesus into your heart. Now, those of us who have been theologically trained know that Jesus remains in heaven. And what comes into our heart is his spirit. But it's not inaccurate, because the spirit of Jesus is Jesus, in the sense that he's his spirit. And so we can understand what that means. And so go back to those days. You probably didn't realize that you were inviting into your heart the consuming fire. It was comforting to be forgiven, and it was awesome to think this Jesus will be my friend forever. He is still a consuming fire. But what keeps him from consuming you is still the three same things that we see in Exodus. The blood of the Lamb, which provides the basis of justification, a right relationship with God. The living intercession of Jesus Christ as your high priest, who stakes his good name, even has given his good name to you, and has your name upon his chest, engraven into his hands before the Father in heaven. And the pulsating big-heartedness of God, who uses his freedom to keep his promises forever. That are the three things that keeps the consuming fire from consuming you and consuming me. And I hope this weekend it is an encouragement to know that message of Exodus ends with God coming down and filling the tabernacle with his glory, and Moses coming down the mountain with his face glowing, that we also have the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ and have the promise of dwelling with him forever because of that grace and that living Savior. Let's pray.